If I asked in a little poll on the way in this morning for you to tell me what John 11 is about, probably 90% of you would correctly say it is about Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead. The one of all of his miracles that most prefigured his own resurrection and his power so to do. And you would be absolutely right. That is what John 11 is about. However, it is not exclusively about that, right? It is a lengthy chapter. And there are many verses before we get to that portion of the narrative. And while the Reverend Pershall may preach on those latter verses on Resurrection Sunday, as many ministers do, and properly so, sometimes as we race to that portion, we overlook the earlier verses. And I think there's merit to giving consideration to those earlier verses also. And this morning, that's why we look at the 20 verses that comprehend John 11, 17 through 37. The resurrection at the end of the chapter is extremely important because it teaches us that Jesus has the power to raise mortal beings from our last enemy, death, right? But these verses tell us a different thing. These verses tell us about Jesus' attitude towards death and towards those who have been aggrieved by it. And that is also an important human reality. And this rich chapter of this rich gospel addresses both of those realities, to the first of which I call your attention today. The passage, as it's structured before us, is actually structured around the two sisters, Martha and Mary. Verses 17 through 27 record Martha coming out and greeting and meeting Jesus. And then the next 10 verses are structured around her sister meeting Jesus. That is to say, if we think John 11 is about Jesus and Lazarus, it is also about Jesus and Martha and Jesus and Mary. Right? They are the focus of our passage. And the passage is held together here. I'll try to demonstrate this point in a minute. What holds our particular passage together is human grief over the horrible reality of death. This passage candidly records not the stoic, unmoved, and unmoving posture of those who cannot be wounded by anything, but the moved and moving posture of those who can feel the weight of the loss that comes when we grieve. It does not set before us people who go through life Teflon coated, uninjured by the curse of Genesis 3, but people who go through the life that you and I do without Teflon, and frequently and sometimes deeply wounded by the realities of the curse of Genesis 3. So note, if you will, five particulars in this passage. And by the way, aren't you glad that I only have five fingers? Don't have eight, don't have 19, you'll be very happy. Five particulars here. Note in the first place that many Jewish friends had gathered to console the grieving Martha and the grieving Mary. Verse 19, many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. Verse 31, when the Jews who were with her in the house consoling her saw her go out. Now, some of you students of the fourth gospel know that the students of it say that the expression the Jews is almost technical in this gospel to refer to those Jewish leaders who so frequently were objectors to Jesus and his ministry. That is to say, in this particular gospel, the expression the Jews is not quite neutral. It's ordinarily a tad negative, right? Because as John tells us in the first chapter, he came to his own, and his own received him not. And so the Jews, to be honest, don't get a very good press in the fourth gospel. And yet here, in this chapter, they are presented well. It's one of the rare places where they are spoken of honorably. And their honor consists in the fact that they've left their other duties and responsibilities to travel to be with Martha and Mary, the text says, to console them in their grief. Note in the second place that when Mary left, the Jews thought that she was leaving to weep. Right? They supposed that. When the Jews who were with her in the house consoling her saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. As though what else would one expect? Third, note that both the Jews and Mary wept, and their weeping is recorded in the text. In verse 33, when Jesus saw her weeping, Mary, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. Notice in the fourth case that both Mary and Martha find it so difficult to deal with the loss of their brother Lazarus that they come dangerously close to accusing Jesus as being responsible for it. Right? Note what it says almost identically. First in verse 21, Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." And then again in verse 32, Mary says the identical words, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." It's not quite an accusation, is it? But it's very close. When a student says to me, "Dr. Gordon, I ordinarily get A's on quizzes from other professors," it's not quite an accusation, but effectively says, "If you knew how to give a quiz, I would have gotten an A." Right? And so also, when these two sisters say this, they are so overwhelmed by their grief that they come this close, dangerously, to blaming Jesus for it. And of course, perhaps most remarkably, Jesus himself expressed profound emotion over Lazarus' death and over the grief of his loved ones. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. Note that Jesus was greatly troubled, it says. An expression that indicates being moved profoundly. The verb appears later in the fourth gospel in chapter 12. At the end of his public ministry, and just before his final words in the upper room with his disciples, as he's preparing to go to Jerusalem to suffer many things at the hands of the chief priests and the scribes and to be put to death, he says to his disciples, "Now is my soul troubled," the same verb in the original we have here. "And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. No, for this reason I came." The same trouble that he expressed as he faced his own crucifixion is expressed here as he deals with Martha and Mary grieving over their brother. He also said a similar thing at Judas's betrayal, recorded for us in chapter 13. After saying these things, Jesus was troubled in his spirit and testified, "Truly, truly, I say to you, one of you will betray me." Can you imagine what his great faithful heart felt at the anticipation of the infidelity of one of his closest friends, and how troubled he must have been? And it's the same verb we have here for the way he felt when he observed the grieving of Martha and Mary. Some interpreters, wrongly in my judgment, have thought that Jesus is actually angry with Martha and Mary in this passage when he says, "I'm troubled." They think that he's troubled that they have wept And then he's scolding them. Right? Bad grievers. Bad grievers. Right? Some interpreters actually think that's what's happening in this passage. As though if they had had better faith, right, their eyes would be free of the moisture that fills ours on occasion. And they are doubly wrong. Such interpretations are misguided on two grounds. First, note that in verse 38, one of those verbs appears again in a context where it is plainly not addressed to humans. It says this, Jesus deeply moved again, same verb, but now again, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone was laid against it. How can you be angry at a tomb? Right? How can you scold a tomb? Right? It's inanimate. It's not a human. His anger is not addressed towards people who grieve the loss of their loved ones any more than it could be addressed to a tomb for doing something inappropriate. A tomb can't do anything. He's troubled because death has grasped another of Adam's children and has broken the heart of those who loved that person. And he's troubled for that reason. Further, if he is scolding them for their weeping, then he must turn around and scold himself, must he not? Because verse 37 tells us, in the briefest text in either the Greek or the English Bible, Jesus wept. So he is not scolding them, and he is not troubled because of their weeping. He's troubled because of the temporary authority death has over Adam's race and the grief that that causes a loving human race. Hermann Ritterboss understood the matter more correctly, as was his custom. And Professor Ritterboss said this, the context as a whole makes clear that Jesus' anger is directed not against ostensible unbelief on the part of Mary and those accompanying her, but against that which brought them to this outburst of grief, the death of Lazarus itself. While this is already the obvious implication of verse 34, it is even more evident in verse 38, where it is not weeping people but the tomb that evokes Jesus' intense emotion of aversion and sorrow. The emotion is the revulsion of everything that is in him against the power of death. Or as Calvin strikingly comments on verse 38, Christ does not come to the sepulcher as an idle spectator, but as a wrestler preparing for the contest. Therefore, no wonder that he groans again for the violent tyranny of death that he had to overcome stands before his eyes. And note that Jesus did not weep because he missed his friend Lazarus. The earlier part of chapter 11 already indicates that he intends to go and raise him, right? It is for God's glory that this has happened, right? So he is not weeping because he's lost a friend whom he will never see again. He knows he will raise him and see him. He wept because Mary, Martha, and the consoling Jews with them were weeping, and so his tears were sympathetic tears, as the one who would identify with them on his cross now identifies with them even in their grief and joins his great loving and redemptive soul to them in their sorrow. Dr. Ritterboss was right again when he said, Jesus weeps with those who are weeping. When the Jews see him as a member of the procession, weeping as he goes, they do not misunderstand him when they say, see how he loved him. Jesus allows himself to be caught up in the general grief over Lazarus' death, and there he experiences and participates in the grief of all whose loved ones have gone to the grave. Christ, far from scolding those who grieved, joined them in their grieving and dignified it, the darkest of our human emotions. Now, there's one reality not expressly taught in this text, apart from which, however, the text makes no real sense. The way musical notes, if you don't put them on the five lines, don't have any meaning. Those lines have to be there for them to mean anything. There's a truth here that makes sense of the text, even though it's not expressly affirmed. And that truth is this. Grief is the cost of love in a mortal world. Grief is the cost of love in a mortal world. If we did not love others, if we cared only about ourselves, right, their departure would not wound us, right? If we could be, if we may say it, perfectly autistic, socially isolated from the rest of the world, death would wound us not at all. But God, who is everlastingly a perfect fellowship of love, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, is the ground and fountain of love in His image, the human. And He has made us essentially to love. And therefore, when we find ourselves in a hapless, mortal world, love wounds us when others die. And it is simply the price we pay in this life for love. As the poet Thomas Lynch put it, grieving is a romance in reverse. And if you love, you grieve. And there are no exceptions, only those who do it well and those who do not. And this is why the Holy Scriptures candidly record, as they do here, the grief of Mary, Martha, and their friends, and with equal candor record Christ's sympathetic grieving with them. Because the Scriptures teach us to love, and therefore they never teach us not to grieve. They only teach us not to grieve wrongly. Not to grieve wrongly. You recall Paul saying to the Thessalonians that you may not grieve as the others do, who have no hope. Right? Do not grieve as the others do, who have no hope. And so Christian grieving is a reality. It is hopeful grieving, grieving with confidence in the resurrection of Christ. And this passage, by disclosing as it does the candid grieving of Martha, Mary, their Jewish friends, and Jesus, right, teaches us about the attitude we should have towards death and those who have been aggrieved by it. Two words, if I may, in application of this text. When you grieve, and note that I did not say if, because I regard you as Christian people with the capacity for love. When you grieve, in the first place, it is appropriate and faithful to be as indignant as Jesus was. Right? If you do not channel this grieving and indignance correctly, you will channel it incorrectly. Right? But you will not be able to evade it. And if you channel it incorrectly, you will do some things that could be harmful to you. Some people have actually written about grief and have said people go through seven stages thereof. Now, I'm always suspicious about that, partly because I think I'm suspicious by temperament, partly because my academic training rewards me for being so, and partly because I've met a few humans in my life and have noticed that they are sometimes temperamentally different. Right? So my suspicion is people do not grieve identically. Right? But among those who think that there are stages of grief, some say the first stage is anger, or the second. Maybe they say the first stage is denial and the second is anger. Right? Anger is a stage that people experience only if they don't have a common biblical doctrine of grief. It is a false surrogate for grief. And the reason some people are angry rather than grieving? It's because they are familiar with anger. Right? They've known it since they were a child. A three-year-old's favorite words are mine and no. Right? And so anger is an old emotion that we've been familiar with since we were very young. And because of that, we feel like we know how to handle it. Right? But grief is a far more unsettling emotion to us. Right? And as a consequence, many people try to evade going there, as it were, as long as they can. They feel emotion. They're afraid to open the Pandora's box of grief. And so they say, I'll substitute anger for it. I know how to be angry. Right? If you do that, you're just delaying the inevitable. Eventually, as a loving person, you have to get to grief. It's there. And you can be angry for a day, or for an hour, or for a month, or a year. And grief is still waiting for you if you are a loving person. And you may as well greet it earlier than later. The failure to grieve properly is utterly destructive, as well as being utterly unchristlike. When we went to Boston Children's Hospital with our first daughter when she was 6 weeks of age and they told us that she had incurable leukemia, one of the things they talked with us about in the third day that we were there, they said, we have to talk to you about something very important. And we thought, well, you just told us in the last 72 hours that our only child is going to die. Now you're going to talk to us about something important. Right? What could you possibly have to say that's more important than that, we thought. And they said this. Now, these figures may have changed since 1986. I don't know. But they told us this that day. 88% of the marriages with a terminal child fail. 88% of the marriages with a terminal child fail. And they felt it is their professional duty to warn us about that reality. And if we say, why would that be? Why would 88% of the marriages with a terminally ill child fail? The answer is probably this, right? Some people will not grieve. They refuse to be wounded by love. And so what they say instead is something like this. I'm going to erect for the rest of my life an emotional barrier. And I'm not going to let anything through. Nothing will hurt me like this again. But then how can you be a loving spouse if you have erected such a barrier? You can't. You just can't. And so if we do not grieve, we not only fail to imitate Christ, but we injure ourselves and others, right? Because grief is the price that loving people pay for living in a mortal world. And if we're unwilling to pay that price, we're going to be wounded. And those around us are going to be wounded also. And so when you grieve, it is appropriate for you to be as indignant and sorrowful as Jesus was. Secondly, when you grieve, not if, when you grieve, feel entirely free to weep with Martha, to weep with Mary, to weep with the consoling Jews, and to weep with Jesus. The same Christ who loved Mary and Martha loves you. And the same Christ who was sympathetic with them in their grieving will be sympathetic with you in yours. When the tears of grief well up in your eyes, and they will, it is not your Christian duty to fight them back. Jesus was not Superman in the face of death, and you therefore need not be either. To the contrary, rather than refusing to grieve, I would suggest to you this. Shed your tears as an appropriate response and expression of love. They are the gift we give to those to whom we can give no other gifts anymore. Right? It is the continued expression of your love to those for whom you cannot send flowers or chocolates or any other thing. All you can give them then is your grieving. So shed your tears as an appropriate expression of love. Shed your tears in obedience to the example of Jesus as a Christian act that reflects his wisdom and compassion. And of course, also shed your tears in confident hope that the Christ who burst through the tomb's doors once will burst through again in the general resurrection and restore you to a world of unfailing and unending love. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, let us pray.